in the Habsburg monarchy, which had miraculously survived. I think this was one of the most, for the Habsburgs, this was almost a miracle, that from the awful depths of despair in the spring of 1848, when the Habsburg monarchy was literally unraveling day to day to day, that a year later the Habsburgs not only had survived, but would come once again to a position of leadership in German Central Europe. In the Habsburg lands, liberalism remained first and foremost associated with nationalism. Nationalism in Bohemia, nationalism in Hungary, nationalism in Italy. It was the only state in Europe where nationalism would remain an exclusively liberal property. Elsewhere, as we will see, would be transformed. The impact of 1848 then on liberalism was, I think, twofold. One is that it would reveal the splits within liberalism between what later would be referred to as classical liberals, moderate liberals, those who were interested in moderate reform, who were willing to live with the idea of constitutional monarchy, those who were certainly wanted to see a constitutional state, but with a limited franchise. Property ought to be the key to the suffrage, most moderate liberals believed, and universal male suffrage, which the Republicans, the other wing of liberalism, had pressed, now seemed to be doubly dangerous. It might lead, on the one hand, to greater radicalism, but now there was a growing fear that actually it would lead to a conservative backlash. For the conservatives, 1848 was also extremely important. Absolutist monarchy, traditional absolutist monarchy, and conservatism remained alive and largely unchallenged in Russia, alive but certainly not unchallenged in Habsburg Austria. But in Central and Western Europe, the liberal revolutions of 1848 probably had a greater impact on the restructuring of conservative thought and strategy than on liberal ideas. The conservatives in Central and Western Europe would draw conclusions, very important conclusions, about the social basis of politics in Europe. They began drawing those conclusions from the obvious point, and that was the presidency of Louis Napoleon in France. Louis Napoleon, as we've seen, was elected by a landslide on December 10th, 1848. He stood for political and economic stability against extremism of both the left and the right. He stood for law and order. The Constitution of the Second Republic was based on universal male suffrage. And it seemed to have resulted in this great victory of Napoleon, Louis Napoleon. He was derisively referred to, as we've seen by Victor Hugo, as Napoleon the Small. Victor Hugo, of course, never suffered from this sort of problem. He was a man who thought that, quite seriously, thought that Paris ought to be renamed as Hugoville. A suggestion that was not taken up by the city fathers. But also Marx, who in his observations about the revolutions of 1848 also spoke with contempt about Louis Napoleon. In a very famous line, Marx had written, and I quote, Hegel remarks somewhere that all facts and personages of great importance in world history occur twice. He forgot to add, the first time as tragedy, the second time as farce. Louis Napoleon was going to provide the comedy, Marx believed. But just as Victor Hugo had underestimated Louis Napoleon, so too had Marx, and so too had Louis Napoleon's opponents in France. Faced with new elections in 1849 in May, which returned a large conservative and monarchic legislature, Louis Napoleon did not yet have an organization in the provinces, most of the deputies of this newly elected legislature, at least, favored some sort of restoration of the Orléans dynasty.